I want to welcome Kate Evans to the studio. Good morning.
Hello, nice to be here.
So we've had the Whangaroa Writers World event on, one event of many that are coming this year, I understand now, and I think you're the last one for this current week. And one of the interesting things about the pop-up bookshop last year, and they've got a pop-up bookshop again this year, was discovering how many writers we've got in our community. And I've just discovered that you're here. You happen to be launching a book right now over this time period, so the coincidence is kind of perfect. But have you been in Raglan long? I didn't know that we had an award-winning writer here.
Yeah, I've been here since 2018.
Okay. And keeping a low profile, perhaps. The writers tend to do that, I feel.
Yeah.
It's kind of a solo activity in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I work in the co-working space down at HQ.
Okay.
And so I know the people there. But yeah, yes, I'm often working online, on Zoom, or travelling around reporting for New Zealand Geographic.
Yeah, because you're basically a freelance journalist now.
Yeah.
So and it says that you report for all sorts of like overseas organisations as well. What's the work you're doing right now? You were telling me as you came in.
Yeah, I'm doing an article for the Scientific American about a new species of fossil crab, a giant crab that was found in Taranaki. So I've been interviewing people, and then I get the drafts back overnight from the editors in New York, and then I have to like quickly answer their questions before they leave for the day.
So it's a lot of science writing that you do?
Yeah, I specialise in science and environmental journalism.
Okay, well, we've got you here because you've got a book launch. The book is called Fijoa, and a story of obsession and belonging, it says. And I'm wondering, did it take a bit of obsession to write a book about Fijoas? Have you always had an obsession with Fijoas?
Yes, 100%. Yes, I've always had an obsession with Fijoas, and it does also take a lot of obsession to write a book. It's taken me 10 years, pretty much.
Is it your first book?
Yes, it is.
You normally write kind of shortish form articles?
Yeah, I write quite long, often many thousand word magazine articles.
Okay,
but,
cool.
This is definitely my first full length. I think this is 70 or 80,000 words.
Right. And it took 10 years, and you travelled a lot overseas chasing information.
Yeah, in bits. So, I had the idea. So what happened was I lived overseas for about 12 years. My Australian partner and I moved back to New Zealand in beginning of 2014. So 10 years ago, and I'd lived away for ages, and I'd really missed Fijo as well. I was away, and whenever I found one when I was overseas and I managed to eat it, like, it was this really emotional kind of homesick feeling. Like, the smell of it would really like transport me back to my childhood in Lee, which is where I grew up.
Yeah.
And then so I just got really curious about how it had this really kind of meaning of New Zealand for me when it comes from South America.
Because I had no idea that that's where it came from.
Yeah.
I'd never thought about it. It's just they've always been here.
Yeah.
Yeah, in my life.
So they come from Uruguay and the southern highlands of Brazil and a little tiny bit of Argentina.
So I presume our temperate climate is perfect
for
them.
Quite similar, yeah, especially to Uruguay.
And I noticed that they look like I can see a tree right now that's grown out of the side of the palm tree, but the leaves of the Pohutukawa, like, there's New Zealand native trees that...
Yeah, they're related.
Superficially look the same?
Yeah, they're in the same family. There's a big family of plants, and it includes eucalyptus as well, but also Pohutukawa and Fijoa. And yeah, there's a lot of similarities with the leaves and the flowers of the Pohutukawa and the Fijoa. And it flowers at a similar time, so it is a little bit like another Christmas tree for us, I think.
Yeah.
But to answer your question about the obsession.
Yeah, the obsession. Back to the obsession.
Yeah, so it... I sort of had this idea. I was really curious about its history. I started researching it, and I just had this idea for a book, which seemed crazy at the time because I wasn't even really writing at the time. I was working in TV, and I was transitioning to be a writer, but I didn't really know what I was doing yet. And so I kind of learned to write well over the time that I've created the book. And so when I back then, I did a couple of trips for work. I didn't have kids yet, so I did a couple of trips for work to some conferences, and I would just tack on these little Fijo missions like onto these work trips.
Did your employers know about this Fijo obsession?
Well, I paid for that part.
Okay,
so, yeah,
all right.
You know, like I would sort of like fly from wherever I was to.
Yeah,
so I went
to
a conference in Peru, and then I went to Uruguay to find out about Fijoas. And then couldn't let go of the idea. I kept pitching it to publishers. They all rejected me. I applied for like 5 different grants in 2018, like the year that I moved to Raglan, and got 2 of them, which gave me some money to go to Colombia, to Brazil, to the south of France, to do the last bits of research that I needed to do.
So who are these people who give grants for people to write books about?
Creative New Zealand and the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. So there's another woman in Raglan that's had one of their fellowships. So they give out a fellowship to do research overseas that you bring something back to New Zealand. And it can be anything. So it's really worth looking into them there.
Yeah. And
various ideas.
It's a beautiful looking book.
Yeah. Botanical art.
Do you have how so you've got a proper publisher? I talk to so many people who self-publish these days.
Yeah.
But you've got a proper, I don't want to use the word proper, that's not fair.
A traditional publishing, it's often called. Yeah, I really wanted a traditional publisher because there are parts of the process that I wanted to do. Like, I've really enjoyed the kind of coming up with ways to get the book out there and marketing and stuff, but like distribution is really hard. So like getting it in all the bookshops. So by having a traditional publisher, like I get $3 or something for whatever book is sold.
Yep.
So they get the most of the profit.
But you don't have to do so
They are in every bookshop and all of the Paper Pluses and all of the Whitcalls and all of the independent bookshops like all over the country. And that is quite hard to do when you're self-published.
Yeah, you know. And have you got representation sorting out interviews and things like that? I think there was someone else in the email chain that
we had. There's a publicist and then I also really wanted to have, like, as a journalist, I really appreciate editing, like having a good editor. And I've worked with a lot of editors, and my stuff is never public. Well, overseas, certainly, like in America particularly, they're extremely rigorous with the way that they edit.
Yeah.
And they take your story apart brutally and then put it back together again, but it's always better. And, like, I really had an appreciation for editing, and I wanted to be kind of rigorously edited.
Yeah.
Hachette, or Moa Press, this new New Zealand imprint, have actually been amazing. So it's been a good experience.
So was it difficult stepping up to the length and having to, like, because I imagine there's pacing issues and things like that when you're doing something so long compared to even long form articles?
Yeah, I think there was a risk of it being a whole lot of features stuck together. The bit that was the most, like, challenging and new for me was kind of including my own personal story, and the version that I submitted to the publisher had less of me in it, and the publisher really wanted more of me.
Actually, I was going to ask about how biographical it was.
Yeah, so there is actually quite a lot of my own, like, journey and my own development coming from being, like, the sort of, like, travelling international person to making a home here in Whangaroa and, like, connecting with this landscape here and settling down, and the whijoa being, like, both a symbol of home and belonging, but also of this, like, connection to all of these far-off places and people that I've met on these journeys. So in the end, like, even though it was really, like, challenging for me, because as a journalist you sort of don't put yourself in very often.
That's almost a rule, right?
Well, yeah, depending on what you're writing and for where.
Okay,
but I think me personally, I've always felt kind of shy of that. But now, having put all of that in there, I love it so much more. Like, it's so much more meaningful to me. That's because there's so much more of me in there.
Yeah.
And
I don't know whether that's a change that's happened these days with the rise of, like, different video media like YouTube, where there has to be a personal connection.
Yeah.
And I've seen film stars say that, you know, it used to be that they kept their distance and there was a mystique, but now people want to know all about you.
Mm.
And there has to be, like, that personal human relationship. So I don't know if that's affected that. And 20 years ago, the company wouldn't have, the publishers wouldn't have said that.
Yeah, possibly not. But I think in this particular story as well, like, there needed to be a link between all of these far off places. Like, there's a sort of a chronology to it, where it starts with the Fijoa's evolutionary history and, like, how it came to be the way it is.
Yeah.
And the ecosystem it evolved in South America, to the indigenous peoples who first would have been the ones to eat it and what we know about them, to the travelling naturalist who first sent squashed leaves back to Europe to be described and named for science, to the guy, the French landscape gardener, who collected the actual plant and started growing it in France, and then how it spread around the world and came to New Zealand. So there's this sort of, like, chronology, and then to the future, like, how we're breeding the Fijoas of the future, basically. So there's this chronology through it, but to connect it, there's my story is kind of part of that. It sort of brings, like, bring you along with me, I guess, as I go through all these places and times.
So, like, it's so common here, like, we almost all of us have a Fijoa plant in our backyard.
Yeah.
And if we don't, our neighbours do. Is it like that in other countries? Are there any other countries like that?
Few. Very few.
Yeah.
So in the Andes of Colombia, which it's not native to there.
Yeah.
It came there around about the same time as it came to New Zealand, slightly later. But they've really embraced it as well. Mm. And it grows in a lot of backyards and stuff over there. And it's widely known, like you can get feijoa juices. I interviewed for this crab story that I interviewed a University of Cambridge Colombian paleontologist, and he said that morning he'd had a feijoa smoothie.
Right.
He was in Colombia at the time. So it's widely, it's used. They use it in a lot of dishes and stuff over there, and they have this one little town has a festival of the feijoa that I managed to go to.
A feijoa festival?
Yeah.
Would you like to start a feijoa festival in this country?
People have tried.
Have they?
Yeah, in Auckland they've been the odd one, but it hasn't, like this Colombian one's been running since the 80s. And it's hilarious. It's amazing. There's like folk music, and it's great.
There's almost, I hope this is not offensive, but there's almost a mundane quality about the feijoas in this country. We just take them for granted.
Yes.
Every now and again, I see people trying to sell them in a supermarket, and I'm like, well, that's going to be a waste of time.
Yeah.
Who's going to buy those?
Yeah. Lots of people I've interviewed have talked about how they're not a fancy fruit. They're like a home fruit. There's something kind of like ordinary and comfortable and every day about them. And then the fact that you don't buy them, I think, is actually part of the reason why I wrote a book about feijoas and not other fruits. Like, there's something different about them. And just because of, like, its particular constellation of, biological traits that it has, that it drops the fruit to the ground all at once. It doesn't keep very well. Mm. There's like, shitloads of it, right? You get to a point in the season where you've just got too many and you can't keep them, and so you give them away. And you give them away to your neighbours, you put them out on the street in a box. I saw a wheelbarrow full of feijoas down on Cliff Street a couple of years ago with a wheelbarrow little sign.
That's ambitious.
Which, it was full, but it was getting, people were taking them. And one of the people I interviewed recently talked about how...
excuse that, they've got a computer that's decided to fix itself in the studio.
But like, because you give them away, or because if you want a feijoa and you don't want to buy it, you go and meet your neighbour. You say, have you got any extra feijoas? You've got that tree there. Would you mind if I take some? And it becomes this like connective tissue in communities and in suburbs and in small towns where it forces you to meet your neighbour, or it gives you an opportunity to meet your neighbour.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting. Like, I remember my kids when they were little, like under 10, someone would bring like a whole supermarket shopping bag of feijoas around, and they would just sit there and devour them. Like, they would have eaten the whole lot if we hadn't sort of slowed them up a little bit. And there must be something in it that their body was crying out for. But also it does taste nice. So I don't know.
A few people have said that they feel like their body just seems to crave feijoas. I met this ultra marathon runner in California who was like the only feijoa lover, you know, for a 100-mile radius. But he was just totally obsessed with them. And they would like go around the streets in Sacramento.
Yeah.
Because they were planted as street trees there, but nobody knew about. No one knew to eat them, so they'd go and offer to clean up the fruit.
Oh no!
And he was like, when I ran, there was something in my body that seemed to crave feijoas. But it seems like you can eat as many as you want without getting sick with feijoas.
Have you personally tried this?
Yeah, I mean, I've eaten buckets at a time for sure.
Well, it was important for the research. sort of experiential research.
Totally.
So is it just going to be sold in New Zealand, the book?
New Zealand and Australia so far.
Okay.
But I really want it to come out in its countries of origin. Like, I really want it to be translated into Spanish and to come out in Portuguese, to come out in Uruguay and Brazil, because I would love them to know the story of their fruit. Mm.
And it sounds like Colombia needs a book as well.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
All the people in the town of Tibasosa like really want to read it, and I really want it to be in Spanish. So I have a literary agent in London who is allegedly trying to get these international...
Allegedly? You don't know. You're asleep while they're working. You don't know what they're doing.
Well, it's just that it just seems to be quite hard because of the feijoa's lack of name recognition. Like, everyone's like, what is this fruit?
Right.
Great book, but what is this fruit?
So everyone in New Zealand knows what a feijoa is, but most of the rest of the world draws a blank.
No, not really, yeah.
People are missing out.
I know. That's what I think.
I mean, would it grow? Would it grow in the UK? It might be too cold.
People are trying. There's an Instagram handle called Growing Feijoas in the UK.
Okay, so, right.
And then they seem to have had some success. But yeah, I think it's mostly too cold. I interviewed Peter Gordon, the chef, and he tried to grow them in his garden in London with not much success.
Right.
It was a bit cold.
Maybe that'll be a benefit of global warming.
Yeah. It seems like if you get a wall or a microclimate or something, you can get it happening.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's funny how Australia hasn't really embraced it the same way as we have at all.
Yeah. Does it grow there?
Quite well.
I'm sure it would in Tasmania. That'd be easy.
Yeah. the Goratezi, Western Australia, even the the Southern Highlands of Queensland apparently are really good. But there's a problem with Queensland fruit fly across quite a lot of New South Wales and Queensland, so they have to cover them with big nets, but it works.
But that's not the thing of we just grow it in our backyard and we don't tend it, they just grow.
Yeah, I guess it has a different meaning there. But there's a lot of homesick Kiwis over there that are pretty happy to buy one.
Oh, yeah, wow. You mentioned Peter Gordon, so have you got some recipes? Can you tell us a good Fiji recipe?
Yeah, well, there's six recipes in the book, one in each part, and they were all contributed by sort of somebody from that place or in that chapter, like one of the characters.
Okay.
And some of them are very simple and some of them are very complex.
Yeah.
One that's not in there that is by Peter Gordon that you could Google is this really beautiful roasted Fijoa and Manuka chutney.
Okay.
Which is really delicious, and I highly recommend that. The book ones, they're sort of too long, I think, most of them, to
just to tell on the radio. People
forget important parts. Yeah, there's one from Colombia from the chef that I met there that's like, you know, like tamales, like it's like a corn thing wrapped in the shell of the corn, you know, what do you call it? Like the husk. And then it's like...
I'm not sure exactly, but that sounds very unexpected to have Fijoa in it. Yeah,
and then it's got like a little caramelised Fijoa sitting in the middle, and they're really yummy. It's kind of like sweet and savoury at the same time. And then the New Zealand chef, Joe McLeod, made me a recipe from venison with wild mushrooms and Fijoa wrapped in pastry, which I haven't tried to make yet, but I'm very excited.
Have you tried it, or...
No, you weren't sent the food. Not in time,
because
it wasn't the right season and I couldn't get any venison.
But yeah, my mouth's kind of watering now. that's interesting. You must have some good contacts to get. If I just went to some famous New Zealand chefs and said, make me something with Fijoa, who are you?
Well, Peter Gordon I interviewed, like he just arrived back in New Zealand during lockdown, and he was in isolation, so he was really bored. So we talked for ages and bonded.
Yep.
And then he's been a huge supporter of the book. Like he wrote a blurb for the cover and stuff.
That. Yeah,
and we're going to do a session together at the Auckland Writers Festival in May. He's just such a lovely man, and he'd been very helpful. And he hooked me up with Joe McLeod, who's this Tuhoi chef who took me into Te Uruwera to look for Fijoas in there, because he had this theory that Ruakinana was growing them in Maungapohatu, like back in the early 1900s, which I wasn't totally sure about, but I was definitely keen to go and find out. So we went in together and we didn't end up finding any old ones, but we actually found a couple of really new Fijoas growing there that someone had just planted right up in the mist in the middle of nowhere in Te Uruwera, which was pretty
cool.
This
is like a wonderful little adventure in your life, this getting this book together.
Totally, yeah. So I just work on, because I had a day job and children, it was all a lot. I just sort of work on it like a month every year kind of thing. And then
it hard to do that? Hard to get into it and walk away from it?
That was the only way I could do it. I couldn't, I'm a terrible morning person. I couldn't get up early and write like some writers.
Yeah.
And after writing all day, doing my day job was exactly the same as the book. So I couldn't then go and do that in the evenings. I just didn't have the brain power. So I had to quarantine that time to kind of sink into it and just write one or two chapters.
What is it like writing all day? Does it wear your brain out? Do you get fit for it?
Do you get fit for it? Good question. No, I've learned that I only really have 3 or 4 hours of really good flow, writing. And the rest of the time I have to do admin, and I could do interviews and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
The actual writing, it does, yeah.
So you're in that flow state. Do you find... The writing just happens. You don't even know. You sit down and you think you know what you're going to do, but by the end of it, your flow state's taking you somewhere else. Or
I guess less so with nonfiction, because you're kind of grounded in the interviews that you've done and papers that you've read and the research and you know the points that you want to make.
Yeah.
But in terms of this, there are times when the sentence, the words seem to flow out. You know, the sentences and the words that go together and the alliteration or whatever. Probably I use too much alliteration. It's probably really dorky, but I quite like it.
Well, actually, the editor will pull you up
if you do it too much.
Too much. You should just do it on purpose once just to see what they do.
They quite like puns. We do quite a lot of puns.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, that's cool. So, folks, we're talking to Kate Evans. Her new book, Fijoa, is out. Oh, there's one right in front of me, but is it out now?
It came out on Tuesday. Zinnia is definitely going to stock it. I'm not sure if they've actually received them in yet. If you like, you can come to my book launch on Friday at the Old School at 6 p.m. because you can buy books there and I will sign them.
Okay.
Otherwise, yeah, you can get them in online and in all good bookshops.
Anything else happening at the book launch? Will there be feed jars?
There are none ready this year.
So you timed it for the feed jar season and then they're late?
Well, I suspect they're actually normal or slightly late, and the last 2 years are really early.
Yeah, okay.
The last 2 years I was getting them in February, like mid to late February, and I was like, oh, I guess the season's moved, so it'll be fine for it to come out at the end of February. But yeah, this year, no way.
Not so much moved as continuing to move. So
yeah, or just it's just quite variable, I guess, and whatever the conditions were this year, yeah, they're just behind. So,
yeah.
Annoying. Oh, well. So not fresh Fijos, but Fijoa wine and Fijoa cider flavored popcorn. I'm getting
Fijoa cider flavored popcorn.
And I need to make a cake. So yeah, my brother-in-law Manu has gifted me a jar of preserved Fijoas from last year, so I can make a cake out of those.
Yeah, we have taken to drying, using the dehumidifier to dry Fijoas.
Nice. Do you,
yeah.
do you
when
peel
I say
them
we,
first?
I mean my wife.
The but, royal we.
Yeah, but I really enjoy to eat them. Yeah, and it intensifies the zing that they have.
That sounds so great. How like do you peel them or how do you cut them?
You peel them and then you slice them. It's quite labor intensive
for your wife.
Well, no, actually, I did help last year. Yeah,
and then
came through the kitchen at the wrong time.
And then is it just like dried apple? You keep them in a jar and you can just stick on them.
Yeah,
do they keep for ages?
Until I've finished with them.
Oh yeah, if they last long enough. Yeah,
yeah. Like we've got I think we have to use them up a little while ago, but they would last till the next season.
That sounds delicious. Oh, you talked about recipes. One thing I've really liked making in the last few years, since I follow the Fijoa hashtag on Instagram, is Fijoa fizz.
Mm.
So after you eat them, you know, you've got all the skins.
Yeah.
And it's something you can do with the skins to use them again, and you put them all in a jar with some water, with some sugar. You dissolve some sugar and water in a jar, and then you put all the skins in, and then you just have to use another little jar to weigh the skins down so that they don't stick up above the water.
Don't rot.
Yeah, and then you leave them for 3 days, and then you've got this like kombucha-like kind of slightly fermented, fizzy, Fijoa sweet thing, and you can add cardamom and stuff, and it's really yummy.
Interesting. That sounds relatively easy to do.
Real easy, yeah.
Yeah.
Just make sure that they're under the water and you can't really go wrong.
Yeah, well, that's brilliant. Hey, I did want to... I know it feels like the interview's finishing.
No, does it?
But, we asked the questions about when's the event, but I actually wanted to ask a little bit about your career, because you've... Mm. It sounds like you've got a flourishing freelance journalism career on the go here, and so many people want to have things like this. Like, how did you... Did you start off wanting to write, or were you starting off in science and then you came to writing? Like...
Yeah, good
did question. You have a grand plan that worked?
No, I didn't really. I think I lost my job at a strategic time.
Yeah.
So I trained in television or kind of radio radio and television and online at the ABC in Australia. And then I went was overseas, was a video journalist for a while. Then my partner was doing his PhD research in Indonesia.
Yeah.
And then I ended up doing a bunch of science kind of communication there for this tropical forest research organization where I kind of learned about like how you talk to scientists and how to read scientific papers and that kind of thing, which I hadn't necessarily thought I was going to do.
Yeah.
And then when I came back to New Zealand, worked for TVNZ, like I got a job there, but then the show I was working on was axed 6 months in, and then I lost my full-time job 6 months after I got back. And so then...
What year was that?
2014.
Oh, yes.
It was 2020.
Yeah.
And then because of that, like I thought I would sort of stay in TV, but that actually allowed me to look around and see what else I wanted to do. And I really loved New Zealand Geographic magazine. I thought it was amazing. Mm. And so I pitched them a story. And then I was like, oh, this is all the things I'm interested in are in this magazine. And then so I've been writing for them since about 2016, I think. Also, I had a kid at the same time, and so it kind of worked. Like I could only work a little bit.
Yeah.
And so I could start off only needing to work a little bit. And so I could build it up over time, like getting more clients and things. But yeah, it's not freelancing in New Zealand. It's not easy. It doesn't pay that well in New Zealand. Overseas, especially American publications, pay better.
Yeah.
So getting some work over there has helped as well.
And is New Zealand Geographic one of the last magazines left in this country?
I mean, there is a version of North and South still and the New Zealand Listener still.
Yeah.
But, yeah, New Zealand Geographic's amazing. It's run on the smell of an oily rag and by very passionate people.
I suspect it always was.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always – it's not the corporate media, you know. It's owned by, like, one guy. right. Not really ordinary guy.
Yeah,
and who's just passionate about the environment and.
Yeah, and I think for its reader base really identifies with it or has an emotional attachment to it. The photography's always been beautiful.
Photography's amazing.
Yeah, that was the place to go in this country before the internet if you wanted to see good photos regularly. Yeah,
that's so true. When Kennedy Warne ran it, and still today the best photographers in New Zealand work, photograph for New Zealand Geographic, including Lottie Headley, who is a local Raglan woman as well. And really? I've done a lot of stories with her.
Hold on, something's happening on here that shouldn't be happening. There was a noise happening which you couldn't hear.
Okay.
But you're the only person in this conversation who couldn't hear it. All the listeners could.
Oh, sorry, everybody.
Yeah. No, that's right. We've trained our audience to expect a little bit of disruption and chaos. Yeah, we're community radio, not RNZ.
Exactly.
We were talking about that earlier. Yeah. You've got to train the audience and you're all good. So would you recommend journalism as a career at the moment? We've just literally, you came in and I just found a thing about NewsHub.
NewsHub is shutting down. That's a whole, about 200 journalists just like losing their jobs overnight. And who knows what they're going to do now. Yeah, I'm a bit concerned about the funding and opportunities for sort of serious good journalism. Was doing a lot of really good work that is now a bit less so. The media landscape is looking a little dicey at the moment, and I'm not sure what's going to happen.
Yeah, well, they were at least, it's an interesting story about how they survived, but maybe they'll have a bit more of the market to themselves now.
But then also it's not good for the country to have just one television news station. It's good for TVNZ to have competitors and for them.
I feel like I'm going to be the main competitor the way things are going. We'll be the last place left in the country doing anything.
I mean, there will be,
because we're not dependent on advertisers for our existence.
Yeah.
But we actually aren't comparable to those organisations in the slightest.
We're running a different way.
Yeah. And we don't have any resources. I was telling you before we came on that I don't have time to prepare for my show or anything like that. Do proper research,
And the other thing is the previous government had the Public Interest Journalism Fund, which was like an influx of money for like serious reporting. And I've spent 2 years being an ocean journalist for New Zealand Geographic, which was funded through New Zealand On Air through that fund, which is about to end as well in March. So I've had a regular income through that. I do want to say there are no strings attached to this government money.
There was some horrendous propaganda around that.
It's bullshit. Yeah. I can write whatever I want, and a lot of the time I criticise the government. I've done a sort of 12 feature stories about the ocean for New Zealand Geographic, and we're just turning them into a podcast on Radio New Zealand, which comes out today. It's called Voice of Tangaroa. A lot of the turning those kind of magazine stories into radio podcast kind of half-hour episodes.
Yeah.
And I've been carrying radio gear around with me, trying to figure out what to do with it and trying not to drop it in the sea because I'm usually on a boat or something.
It's probably quite expensive if it's air gear.
Yes, so. I know. I'm a bit worried. But anyway, it seems to have survived.
They probably do lose them from time to time, for sure. Mm. Yeah.
Anyway, it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next couple of years because across the board that money's kind of run out.
Yeah. And I don't feel like this government
seems unlikely.
Their plans appear to have been, we're going to stop a whole lot of things from happening.
Yeah.
And then now they're like, oh, but what are we actually going to do? So, they're kind of at that point.
Watch this space.
Mm. All right, well, look, Kate, great to meet you this morning.
You too.
And I hope you have a good book launch and the book does well.
Thank you.
And maybe we'll talk to you again sometime in the future when you've got a new project going.
Love to.
I'm sure you have more.
Yeah, actually all of them seem to be coming out in the same week at the moment.
Okay. Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah. Hope you do well.
Thank you.
All right, folks, that was Kate. And, the time, we should say the time and place again. Friday night.
Friday night at the old school, 6 p.m. Come and say hi. You can buy the book.
And get it signed.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, there we go. That is the end of the show for the day. Hope you enjoyed it. And I'll be back again tomorrow morning.